Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I'm just back in Manchester from Gaza. I'm calling for a full ceasefire to alleviate the suffering of Palestinians. I'm also calling for accountability for war crimes committed by Israel in Gaza, and accountability for anyone that was complicit in Israel's war crimes by funding them or supporting them politically. And ultimately, I'm looking for a political process that leads to justice and self-determination for Palestinians.
As Israel intensifies its attacks on what are supposed to be safe zones in central and south Gaza, we'll speak with a Palestinian scientist who fled Gaza and just arrived in Britain, where he has dual citizenship. Then hundreds of Jewish activists and their allies shut down the California state capitol in Sacramento Wednesday to demand a Gaza ceasefire. We'll speak with one of them, a descendant of Holocaust survivors who is a former IDF soldier.
My elders, state, family had meticulously taught me how to recognize genocide from infancy, how naked bodies get rounded up for torture and execution, how mass graves smell, how starvation and hate shapes a body, how ethnic cleansing martyred entire lineages and buries the wisdom of the land caretakers. The black and white images are now in color. The stories are live. And in this cycle, we don't need gas chambers because we have U.S.-made bombs.
And we'll speak with Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time former presidential candidate, about U.S. support for Israel and his new book, The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, the death toll from Israel's 90-day bombardment has topped 22,600, with another 7,000 people reported missing, presumed dead. Health officials in Gaza say Israel killed at least 162 Palestinians over the last 24 hours as the IDF intensifies its attacks on refugee camps in central and south Gaza, areas once deemed by Israel to be safe. Doctors in Gaza described horrific conditions inside the few hospitals still open. Yasser Khan is a Canadian ophthalmologist who's working in the European hospital in Khan Yunis.
Almost every hour, someone's coming in with an explosive injury or a serious injury. People are losing their legs, their eyes, their lives. And the people, the healthcare workers are working here 24 hours every single day. With nothing, with no resources, nothing, no medications, anesthetics, everything is out.
Israeli officials have reportedly held talks with a number of African nations, including the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, and Chad, about accepting Palestinians pushed out of Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and some of his cabinet members have promoted what they call voluntary migration from Gaza. But Palestinians and human rights groups have decried the plan as ethnic cleansing. This comes as Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom, Tzipi Hotovely, has openly embraced destroying the whole of Gaza. She made the comment during an interview on the London radio station LBC.
One of the things we realized is that every school, every mosque, every second house has an access to tunnel. So this is, and of course, ammunition.
But that's an argument for destroying the whole of Gaza, every single building in it.
So do you have another solution how to destroy the underground tunnel city, that this is the place where the terrorists hide?
Meanwhile, the Biden administration's criticized South Africa for filing a genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. National Security Council Coordinator Admiral John Kirby was asked about the case on Wednesday.
South Africa's filed this 84-page lawsuit against Israel, accusing them of genocide. Israel says that this is blood libel. Does Washington agree? And where does this put Washington and Pretoria in terms of
this? We find this submission meritless, counterproductive, and completely without any basis in fact whatsoever.
In other news from Israel, an Israeli woman who was held hostage by Hamas for 51 days is calling on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to declare a ceasefire. Aviva Siegel spoke to PBS NewsHour.
But he can't keep the war going and get the hostages out. He needs to go to a ceasefire and then get them out. And he needs to get them out now, as quick as possible.
The Iraqi government is blasting the United States after a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad killed a top commander in an Iran-backed militia. An Iraqi military spokesperson described Thursday's attack as a dangerous escalation and an assault on Iraq. Pentagon spokesperson Brigadier General Patrick Ryder claimed the U.S. was acting in self-defense.
This individual was actively involved in planning and carrying out attacks against American personnel. And as we've long said, we maintain the inherent right of self-defense and will take necessary action to protect our personnel.
In Iran, funerals have begun for the 84 people killed Wednesday in a pair of bomb blasts in the city of Kerman. On Thursday, the Islamic State took responsibility. The group said two suicide bombers had attacked the crowd who were gathered near the tomb of the Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. The bombings occurred on the fourth anniversary of Soleimani's assassination in Iraq by the United States. In Japan, the death toll from this week's massive earthquake has risen to 94, with over 220 people still missing and feared to be trapped under rubble. Earlier today, an 80-year-old woman was pulled from the rubble more than 72 hours after the quake. Civil rights leader Al Sharpton led a protest Thursday outside the New York office of the billionaire investor Bill Ackman, who helped lead a campaign that led to this week's ouster of Claudine Gay, Harvard University's first black president. Ackman is a Harvard alum and major donor to the university, who's publicly railed against Harvard and other schools for supporting DEI. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Al Sharpton vowed to keep protesting outside Ackman's office.
We have started these weekly one-hour protests in front of Mr. Ackman's office. He has said that the resignation of Ms. Dr. Gay at Harvard is not the end of it. They're going to keep fighting to the end DEI, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's declaring a war on all of us, blacks, women, gays. DEI was designed to bring fairness and equality to people that had been historically marginalized and eliminated.
Sharpton was standing in front of someone holding a Haitian flag as part of his campaign to oust Claudine Gay as Harvard president. She's the daughter of Haitian immigrants. Bill Ackman helped amplify allegations that Gay had committed plagiarism in her academic work. But now Bill Ackman's wife, MIT professor Neri Oxman, is facing a plagiarism scandal of her own. Business Insider has revealed Oxman plagiarized parts of her doctoral dissertation at MIT. On Thursday, Oxman apologized and admitted making mistakes. New York City Mayor Eric Adams has sued 12 charter bus companies for $700 million, accusing them of illegally transporting over 30,000 migrants from Texas at the behest of Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Adams accused Abbott of using the migrants as political pawns.
These companies have violated state law by not paying the cost of caring for these migrants. And that's why we are suing to recoup approximately $700 million already spent to care for migrants bused here in the last 2 years by the state of Texas.
A new report by House Democrats accuses former President Donald Trump of repeatedly and willfully violating the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. The report found foreign countries, including China, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, spent at least $7.8 million on apartments and hotels at Trump-owned properties while Trump was president. Congressmember Jamie Raskin of Maryland accused Trump of, quote, elevating his personal financial interests and the policy priorities of corrupt foreign powers over the American public interest, Raskin said. Saturday marks the third anniversary of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. President Biden's planning to mark the anniversary by giving a speech near Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, the Revolutionary War site where George Washington and the Continental Army camped over the winter of 1777-1778, enduring harsh conditions. Meanwhile, voters in Massachusetts and Illinois have filed paperwork challenging Donald Trump's eligibility for running for office, citing the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment. Trump is already appealing decisions in Colorado and Maine to remove him from the ballot. Newly unsealed documents related to the deceased convicted sex trafficker and financier Jeffrey Epstein includes a reference to reports that former President Bill Clinton once threatened Vanity Fair magazine against reporting on Epstein. One new document contains an email sent by Virginia Giuffre, who had accused Epstein of trafficking her to Prince Andrew when she was 17 years old. In the email, Giuffre writes about why she was worried about speaking to Vanity Fair. She wrote, quote, "It does concern me what they could want to write about me, considering that B. Clinton walked into VF and threatened them not to write sex trafficking articles about his good friend, J.E." Former Vanity Fair editor Graydon Carter has denied the incident ever took place. In Iowa, a sixth-grade student died Thursday in a school shooting in the town of Perry on the first day of classes after winter break. Five other people were injured, including the school's principal. Police say the gunman was a 17-year-old student who came to school armed with a pump-action shotgun and a small-caliber handgun. Police say the shooter died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And in Berkeley, California, police raided the historic People's Park early Thursday morning, ending a long standoff between the University of California, Berkeley, and community activists. There were reports at least seven people were arrested. Many unhoused people were displaced. In the 60s, People's Park was at the center of the anti-war and free speech movements in Berkeley. The UC Berkeley officials have now placed shipping containers around the perimeter of the park where the school plans to build new student housing. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where the death toll from Israel's 90-day bombardment has topped 22,600, with another 7,000 people reported missing and presumed dead. Health officials in Gaza say Israel killed at least 162 Palestinians over the last 24 hours as the IDF intensifies its attacks on refugee camps in central and south Gaza, areas deemed by Israel to be safe zones. Doctors in Gaza describe horrific conditions inside the few hospitals still open. In a minute, we'll be joined by a Palestinian man who just arrived in Britain after fleeing Gaza. Mohamed Galiani is an air quality scientist who spent nearly 3 months in Gaza, where he had been visiting family. He just returned to Manchester, England, Wednesday, where he has dual citizenship. This is Galiani speaking at the airport after his arrival in Britain.
After spending 65 days under Israel's brutal bombing, I made what was to me an impossible choice. One that I've been fearing since the beginning of the attack, and that was the privilege of my British passport to leave Gaza. It's a choice not available to the majority of Palestinians in Gaza. People who are currently suffering from malnutrition, severe dehydration, and an overwhelming public health crisis. As Israel relentlessly and openly pursues the campaign to force all the people out of Gaza, be it by death or forced relocation to Egypt. I actually fear that we may never see our home again.
Mohamed Galiani speaking after landing in Manchester Wednesday, joining us now from Manchester, also the co-founder of Amplify Gaza Stories, which works to share voices from Gaza. Mohamed Galiani, you were in Gaza with your family. You fled first to Egypt on December 10th, and now you're home in Manchester. Can you lay out what you saw? Can you talk about Israel's bombardment of Gaza?
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me on. Goodness, that's quite a difficult question to answer comprehensively, but I'll try. I just need to take a moment. It's it was really hard to imagine things getting any worse on any particular day, but they did keep getting worse. I think that's probably like one way to look at it.
Can you, start off by telling us where you were? We'll just go through some of the facts.
Yeah,
you've gone to Gaza to see your family. When did you go?
I traveled to Gaza on the 18th of September for an extended visit, both to see my family, but also to look at moving back there for work. I've been out of Gaza for almost 20 years now. You know, the trip was going as planned. On the morning of the 7th of October, I had got up quite early to go harvest olives with my cousins. And as I woke up, I saw rocket trails that gave me the first tip off that something was off. As the rocket fire lasted into more than an hour, it really started becoming apparent how significant the day was. Then there was a bombing, an Israeli aerial bombardment 50 meters from our apartment that shattered all the glass there. And we at that point started taking the decision to leave the apartment because it's actually quite close to the beach, so not a great place to be. And then began a succession of displacements, first to an apartment about a kilometer away, then to my father's home and IVF center, then to a hotel in North Gaza that was supposedly a safe haven because of its, you know, shelters journalists and aid workers. I've since learned that that's been destroyed, as has my father's IVF and center and home. On the 13th of October, we, you know, with bombing happening all around us, you know, we saw tower blocks that housed thousands of people being bombarded for 36 hours. And then eventually they were like brought down after this wanton bombardment. Destruction everywhere that you looked, wherever you went. And on the 13th of October, Israel issued an order to the population of Gaza, an illegal order, I might add, telling people to leave, to go south of Wadi Gaza, the Gaza River. And, you know, it set a lot of people into a panic. And anyone that had an ability to leave, a lot of people left, and we were among them. It was a very, very difficult choice then, because because it's like an impossible choice or a false choice between, I guess, your safety and your home. And then, you know, if you consider the headlines that you were the headline about the bombardment in areas of Khan Yunis in the south that were deemed as, in quote, safe zones. We found out, as did hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, that nowhere was actually safe in Gaza. And I think that's all part of this strategy of terrorizing Palestinians, sowing deliberate confusion until people, like, at the end of their tether, because they have no access to water, scarce food, and no access to healthcare, and you know, people are like, eventually are going to be asking themselves, well, where should we go? And you know, I truly am of the belief, and I think there is like evidence to suggest that Israel is trying to push Palestinians into the Sinai. They'll deny it, and their supporters will deny it. But ultimately, Israel is a master of creating facts on the ground. And plausible deniability, I guess. I can carry on if you want, like, recounting our journey.
Let me ask you something. You're an air quality scientist. Can you talk about the air quality in Gaza with this massive level of bombardment?
Excuse me. So I've got a cough now. And I think throughout my time in Gaza, I had a cough, and I think the coughs are quite common right now, and part of that is because of the number of respiratory irritants that are in the air because of the bombardment. So starting with the rubble from buildings that, when it's bombed, are pulverized into fine particles that that every time there's a gust of wind spread in the air and create an elevated level of particulate matter. But it doesn't stop at rubble from buildings and other explosive residue and what have you, because you also have, because of the lack of power right now, people are relying on alternative fuels to both. So, for example, solid fuel for cooking is so common. So you walk down any street and it's thick with smoke from countless fires that are being lit just to substitute for gas. And then add to that, because of the lack of transport fuel, people are fueling their cars with cooking oil that, again, is not a good substitute for diesel because it has like a higher, a worse emission profile that, again, causes, untold public health harms. And I think, those are the key air quality issues right now.
Can you talk about the Israeli so-called fire belts, the name of the rapid succession strikes that destroy whole Gaza city blocks?
Yeah, it's really something horrific to behold, because you hear the whoosh of a jet and then you hear the explosion that results from, say, a one-ton bomb that's laid down. And then you think, okay, is that it? And then you hear 10 more in quick succession that just like surround or saturate a neighborhood with bombardment. And people have nowhere to go. So for example, as I was saying, we were in this location in North Gaza, next to the Mukhabarat towers in North Gaza by the beach, and these towers were subject to almost 24-hour successive fire belts. Some people came to us; they came to seek shelter where we were, and they said, we couldn't leave. We were pinned down by bombing all around us. It's this massive, indiscriminate use of explosive power in densely populated areas without any regard for civilian lives in those areas. And it's very cynical because, I think initially, an Israeli military spokesperson says we are seeking damage, not accuracy, in their bombing. But then at the same time, they keep saying our strikes are very targeted and our strikes only focus on terrorist infrastructure or whatever, like that kind of tired terminology of terrorism that they use. And then later on, we find out that more than 50% of the munitions dropped on Gaza were not smart targeted bombs, but rather just, it's really hard. I mean, being in it, but also just being around it and hearing, knowing that every explosion is another family being killed and displaced and losing their home.
Mohammed, on an Instagram post in early November, you said, "Really sad to hear that my dear cousin Leila Al-Haddad's uncle's family have been killed by the Israeli bombing of their home in Gaza City. I didn't know them, but feel your pain, Leila," you write. You said you acknowledged their murder on an interview with BBC 5 Live just now, and the presenter tried to mince words that they needed to verify. Your response?
Again, the ultimate slight or cynical denial of the suffering of Palestinians. On the one hand, we are expected to mourn and kind of acknowledge the death of Israelis, and as humanitarians, we do. Expected to accept the Israeli government's narrative of that. But on the other hand, Palestinian suffering and Palestinian deaths that are much more documented are each one is dissected and analyzed ad infinitum to deny the genocide that is going on. And I will call it a genocide. I mean, it's the ultimate in dehumanization. I'm sorry. Every time I report someone that I know or someone or a relative that's been killed by Israel, I'll be asked, but do you have proof that it was Israel? We can't verify that, surely, so we can't mention this. It's horrible.
80 members of your extended family have died in Gaza.
Yes, so 15 of my mother's cousins were killed in their home in Khan Yunis in early October. Later in October, another 10 of my mother's cousins, 20 of my father's cousins, and others that I've almost like lost track or lost count. And it's just my coping strategy is in some way to try and not know, but obviously you know you can't avoid it. I think one of the most horrific incidents that really stood with us though was in late December. Well, on the 19th of December, we got the news that six of my cousins, along with their in-laws from the Anan family, so Ghalayini family and the Anan family, who were sheltering in the home of the Anan family in Gaza City, they'd been surrounded by the IDF for a couple of days, and then the Israeli army went into the house. They separated the men from the women. So, like in that process in itself, in being able to separate men from women, it's telling in terms of the level of threat or lack thereof. And then 15 of the men in the home were shot by the Israeli army, and then they also threw explosives into the rooms that the women were sheltering in, and many of them were injured as well. This has been documented by the Euromed Human Rights Monitor. It's also been a press statement was issued by the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And the Israeli army has form when it comes to summary executions. They executed their hostages as they were walking towards them, bare-chested, waving white flags. And I'm fearful for everyone I know that's in Gaza from either meeting an explosive death or a death by trigger-happy, genocidal soldiers who are like drunk, obviously, on the power that they are wielding. And
Mohammed, I wanted to get your response to Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom, where you have dual citizenship, Tzipi Hotaveli, who has openly embraced destroying the whole of Gaza. She made the comment during an interview on the London radio station LBC.
One of the things we realized that every school, every mosque, every second house has an access to tunnel. So this is, and of course, ammunition.
But that's an argument for destroying the whole of Gaza, every single building in it.
So do you have another solution how to destroy the underground tunnel city, that this is the place where the terrorists hide?
So that's the Israeli ambassador to the UK. Can you first respond to Tzipi Hotaveli?
Of course. Tzipi Hotaveli needs to be expelled from the United Kingdom. She is a purveyor of fake news that is a way of manufacturing consent for Israel's genocidal actions. And the UK government needs to expel her as a diplomat. She is a propagandist, not a diplomat. And, she is someone that is providing making the case for Israel to continue with this impunity in its war crimes, and it's all fake news with no proof. But like in the end, if you have a position of power and access to the media, then you're often unchecked and unquestioned. Unfortunately, not all media. I mean, I'm glad the presenter challenged her, but I don't know how far the challenge went in that piece. And ultimately, there's a lot of bad journalism going on. And I guess this is like one of the reasons why this is so important to have like independent media like Democracy Now, and also like independent voices on social media.